This is News in No Time. I'm Tony Cox. We've been talking politics today, hashing out the winners and losers of last night's GOP debate in South Carolina. Now we'd like to take a look at how all the campaigning may play out in the Palmetto State. Joining us for our Reporters Roundtable today are Michael Fletcher, national economics writer and former White House correspondent for The Washington Post, Viola LeBay, an education reporter also for The Post, and Corey Dade, who is an Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us on the campaign trail in South Carolina. Welcome to all three of you.
Good to be here, Tony.
Hi there. Hello.
Corey, let's start with you. Since you are in South Carolina, give us a quick peek into what the future holds on the ground there in the next several days.
Well, South Carolina has become the next battleground for several reasons. Blacks make up half the turnout in the Democratic primary, so this is the first test for the candidates in appealing to blacks and to really gauge where masses of black voters are. South Carolina also sets the tone for how the rest of the South may vote and provides the most significant momentum for the winner of this primary heading into the February 5th primaries. So on the ground here, Clinton and Obama have taken different approaches. The Clinton campaign has locked up early endorsements from black politicians and ministers, while the Obama campaign has built a pretty large field organization to push into black neighborhoods. And then you have, of course, John Edwards, who has established South Carolina as his firewall. He was born here. He still has family ties here, and he won the South Carolina primary in 2002. So at this point, most polls show Obama leading Clinton among blacks and among all Democratic voters overall, and notably, the polls show that he's tied with Clinton among women.
You know, we're hopefully we'll be able to get your line a little cleaned up. We could hear you, but there's some difficulty there. We apologize to the audience for that. We're going to work on it. You mentioned polling, and that's an interesting point. I'd like to come to Michael Fletcher to talk about that, because on the heels of the New Hampshire primary, Newsday put out an article slugged, "Where Did Pollsters Go Wrong in New Hampshire? What is the role of the political pundit, and what's the point of listening to them if they're wrong or at least not always right?" Now, I mentioned the compressed primary schedule earlier in a conversation that I had about its possible impact. And I'm wondering from your point of view, Michael, how the quick turnarounds are affecting the business of predicting the outcomes.
I think it's tougher because everything, as you said, gets compressed. And pollsters will tell you that often things swing late. But, you know, late becomes a shorter time window now. So a lot of the polling in New Hampshire was done, you know, by that Saturday. And, you know, by the time that ended, you know, things had shifted. So when you have a compressed window, it just makes it, I think, a lot harder to catch kind of the turns and the swings in the electorate. Not only that, they, as you know, they talk about having some problems with the samples, and there was a bigger turnout than anticipated. So all of those things can skew what you see in a poll.
Theola, isn't the schedule itself a bit confusing for voters? It is quite a change from what we're used to.
Let me tell you, I've got friends who are covering this election, and I don't know whether we can go out for a drink on a certain day or have dinner, because one day they're slated to be in South Carolina. They may turn around the next day and then head out to Ohio. And as someone who is following this, not just also personally, but also professionally, I do know that all politics is local. And what I'm seeing here in the nation's capital, but more for the area and residents here, is that they're still waiting to hear some of these substantive issues talk to know, okay, where is Obama, let's say, on education, for example? Or I think that maybe for Edwards, we do know where he stands on some of the issues like lobbyists and such. But, you know, those pocketbook taxes sorts of issues where folks can say, I want to vote for this person because I know how they will affect the economics of my personal household.
Well, you know, this will be the first time, Corey, I believe you're back with us, right?
Yes.
All right. This is the first time that we will get a chance to see a substantive block of black voters choose, on the Democratic side at least, between, presumably, Obama and Hillary Clinton. Do you have a sense of how that is going in South Carolina right now?
Well, at this point, South Carolina is the battleground for so many different reasons. Obviously, blacks make up half the turnout in the Democratic primary. But beyond that, this result will set the tone for how the rest of the South may vote, and it provides significant momentum for the winner heading into the February 5th primaries. As far as the black vote here, the Clinton and Obama camps have taken sort of different approaches. The Clinton campaign locked up early endorsements from prominent black politicians and ministers, while the Obama campaign, because they initially lacked the name recognition, built a large field organization aimed at reaching black voters directly in their communities. And at this point, Obama has now taken the lead from Clinton in the polls among African-American voters and Democratic voters overall in the state. And most significantly, perhaps, is that Obama now is tied with Clinton in the polls among women.
You know, it's one thing to think back to when Jesse Jackson first ran for the presidency and how that energized the black community, not only in terms of debate, but also in terms of voter turnout. Is there any sense that Obama's presence in South Carolina is going to affect the turnout, particularly among black voters, Corey?
I think so. There's every sign of that. In that he has gone after young black voters who have never voted before. But what's also significant is that his a huge portion of his get out the vote effort relies on volunteers who are unpaid, who are black, who are under 35, and have never participated in the process before. So that's one issue. The other issue is that the more this becomes contested by both candidates, the more attention South Carolina gets, the more they get the attention, particularly of rural blacks. So as long as this is a hot battleground, there is every indication that this could be, if not a record turnout among blacks in South Carolina, but a big one.
Let's move on to another topic. I'm going to come to you on this, Michael Fletcher. President Bush announced this week he thinks there will be a signed peace treaty between Israel and Palestine by the time that he leaves office. Talk, if you will, about the timing of such an announcement and the attention that it has generated in the press. Is it skepticism, optimism, what?
Well, I think among the press is a lot of skepticism, and because this is the same President Bush who for so long, you know, wasn't really deeply involved in the Middle East peace process. I mean, they laid the roadmap, as they call it, in the early part of his administration. But since then, it has been largely a hands-off issue for President Bush. Then, of course, I mean, the Baker-Hamilton Commission and it, you know, mentioned that the United States should take a more active role in trying to bring about some kind of, broker some kind of long-term deal between the Palestinians and Israelis as a way to kind of, take the energy out of the sort of anti-Americanism in the Middle East and among Islamics generally. And so I think you see President Bush's action motivated by that, you know, most of all. But I don't know that he can really deliver on what he says, because there are a lot of hurdles in the way and the things he's talking about, what to do with Jerusalem, things like that. I don't think these things will be settled, because these are old issues that have deep-seated feelings on both sides.
Viola, if he is successful, it would certainly be a boost not only for President Bush but for the Republican Party as well. But if it falls apart, especially before the November elections, how might the presidential campaign be affected, if at all?
You know, Tony, it's very interesting. We have talked before about the time that I spent in Iraq. And as I watch this presidential campaign, I think that the Arab world is very closely watching this election, because Bush, to them, in some respects, has been a pretty significant president in terms of influencing policy there, obviously with the invasion into Iraq and some of his other comments about neighboring states and such. And so I'm not sure if something is signed or not, kind of how that might play out, because largely I've seen and heard the candidates talk very opaquely about Iraq and about the Arab world, because right now the message seems to be focused on change and which candidate can actually claim the mantle of change. And that to me is also on the GOP side as well as the Democrats.
Let me let our audience know what we are doing. You're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Tudeh today. If you are just tuning in, with me on today's roundtable are Michael Fletcher, Theola LaBey, both with The Washington Post, and Corey Dade with The Wall Street Journal. Corey, an outgoing president is in a tough spot, isn't he, when he comes to leading the nation and at the same time trying to help his party stay in the White House during a tough, close race. How effective is a president at being presidential and partisan now that we're in the middle of the primary, at the beginning of the primary season?
Well, I think President Bush has shown no problem in being partisan. I don't think that will change going forward. I think what's significant is that none of the Republican candidates for the nomination have been able to latch themselves to his record. They have tried to find ways to express support for continued occupation of Iraq and pressing the war, but at the same time have distanced themselves from the president, and I think that will continue. As far as Bush is concerned, he has given every indication that he's going to try to give the Republican Party some victories, because it's not just about the presidential holding on to the White House for the Republicans. It's also about gaining seats in the House if they can and holding on to their slight advantage in the Senate. So this has reverberations for all the congressional elections that are going on this year.
Well, Michael, you've covered the White House before. Is there a point at which you determine as a member of the press corps that you see the White House prerogatives beginning to move in diverging directions? Because as Corey was just talking about, on one hand, you have to remain presidential. On the other, you have to protect the party if you can. And thirdly, you have to try to protect the seats in Congress.
You know, it's been interesting with this White House because I think a lot of Republicans in Congress actually are frustrated with President Bush. Before the midterm elections, for example, many Republicans were hoping he would make some kind of significant move in terms of changing strategy in Iraq. And he waited until after the elections to, to fire Rumsfeld and things like that. So this president has been somewhat unique. While he's been kind of pushing his agenda, pushing for his foreign policy. And I think with the rationale being that if he's successful, that in the end will help Republicans. But along the way, he's really kind of broken with what a lot of congressional leaders would have liked to have seen. They say he doesn't listen to them. President Bush has done a lot of spending as president, and that's left a lot of Republicans vulnerable in Congress. So he's been kind of a president interested in furthering his presidency.
When the president was reelected to office in 2004, he declared that he had earned political capital. This is my last question about that. We're going to move on to another topic. And he intended to spend that capital. Theola, although he seems to be spending it now, how much capital does the current president currently have?
I think when you wake up to headlines about countrywide stock falling precipitously and then needing a buyout, I think that those sorts of things are tied directly to Bush, and that capital is dwindling, if not, dead. I mean, someone once said famously, it's the economy, stupid. And I think that clearly that has emerged of the story of 2008. And everyone now is looking ahead because of this contest for president. And because, as Michael said, Bush has been so good about thinking about Bush and then his legacy, I think that folks are now saying, look, we went into Iraq. We had a president who said, I am the decider. And now, years later, I may not be able to refinance my mortgage. And so I want somebody new. I want change. I'm just really not sure who that might be.
Final thing is this. You might call this story the tale of the videotape. It's an update on a story that we have been watching this week. U.S. Navy releasing footage of a reported Iranian speedboat racing and circling three American warships going through the Strait of Hormuz. Reports of the encounter describe an Iranian in one of the small boats threatening the warship by saying over the two-way, I'm coming to you, you will explode after a few minutes. And then yesterday, the Iranian state television issued its own version, its own videotapes showing something very different. We have two clips. Here's the first one. This one is of the Iranian TV.
Coalition warship 73. This is Iranian Navy patrol boat. Request side number Hilo operating in the area this time. Over.
Now, that was the Americans. Here comes the American version of another part of that encounter.
I am coming to you. You will explode.
Now, what do we make of this? We didn't hear the full encounter from either side. How do you approach something like this, Michael?
It's very tough. I note today that the Pentagon has backed off of its well, I guess they say they didn't make the assertion, but they now say that there's no telling that this alleged threat came from the patrol boat, because apparently this is an open channel and that could have been a transmission from another boat, even not that close to the American warships. But nonetheless, the Americans are sticking to this idea that it was a provocative act by the Iranians, the way they were maneuvering the small boats. At one point, they claim one of the boats dropped a box into the water, and that was a threatening and a very dangerous move, according to the Americans. But it is interesting that they've backed off of perhaps the most explosive assertion.
We don't have a lot of time left, but Corey, how important is Iran in terms of the president's foreign policy portfolio, do you think?
Well, at this point, you know, the president is the lame duck. So the fact that they are trying to shift to Israeli relations with Palestine and those issues kind of demonstrates that Iran is going to be less important going forward, because you have a national intelligence estimate that revealed sort of the status of Iran's nuclear development program. And I think that gave the administration, clearance, as it were, to sort of back away from those, from the contentiousness of those relations. And I think at this point, there may continue to be sparring back and forth, but the White House knows that neither Congress nor the American public has the will give the support for escalating any type of conflict with Iran, with the nation still engaged in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I think you will see the U.S. over the next year, as you're certainly the president, sort of keep issues of Iran at bay as best they can. And I don't look at this latest controversy as being a significant escalation going forward.
That's taking the time that we have to talk about this subject today. I thank you all for coming with us, Theola, Mike, and Corey. Michael Fletcher is national economics writer and former White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Theola LeBay, an education reporter also for The Washington Post. Both she and Mike joined us from The Washington Post studios in our nation's capital. And Corey Dade with The Wall Street Journal.